Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, this Monday edition on 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on today's program, danger this summer, a lot more ticks and mosquitoes than normal, and of course a chance for diseases that those vermin carry, if you call them that. Also, from Melanie Phillips in the Jerusalem Post, an article, "As I See It, the Fight to the Death in Britain and America." Also, good news in the health front. If you don't have enough sleep, that's okay. They say you can eat chocolate, and that'll take care of it. We'll see. Also, information about the Battle of Gettysburg, some history there. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm. Also email us any comments you have, comments at kpcg.fm. We're happy to take a look at those for you. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here on this Monday. Grant, you're a father now. You had a baby on Friday. And so, so far, so good.
Yes, Loma Amy, little girl, very adorable. it's funny because babies are really helpless, but at the same time, they're pretty powerful because they get adults to do for them whatever they want. So I've noticed that pretty quickly. Loma has like a hint of manipulative abilities where she can start screaming like there's a big problem, but as soon as Anya walks around the corner, she stops. So it's like she just wanted attention or something like that.
Yeah, you have to, I guess you learn to differentiate between the cries as mm-hmm. as it goes. The attention cry versus the I'm hungry / in pain or something sort of cry. So you didn't have a baby, did you, Abraham, over the weekend?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. No, yeah. So only one. Only one baby. The other big news on Friday, almost as big, is Paul George is coming to the Oklahoma City Thunder. Yeah. So that's huge in the free agency news. That was a surprise. That was a shocker, at least for me. I didn't think OKC was going to have a shot at him.
That's pretty funny. Two big additions to Oklahoma City on the same day. My daughter, Paul George.
Right.
We got a pretty big Thunder fan in our midst now. Actually, the hospital gave her a free all-pink Thunder outfit.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, I can be taking her to the games, and she'll be able to watch Paul George, which is pretty incredible we got him. Obviously, they're going to have to convince him to stay in Oklahoma City right after this year because – a lot of people think he's just going to go to the Lakers after this year.
Yeah, it's Oklahoma City is on the way to L.A. from Indiana. Who knows? You know, if they play real well, maybe he'll stick around. But at least it makes us pretty competitive this next year. So, yeah, it's always interesting when you see the little babies at the Thunder games. The parents always put the headphones or the muffs on them because it is really loud. I think the youngest that my kids were when I took them, I think my daughter was a year or so. I she would have been older than that, but she didn't like the first go around. So much happening, a little overwhelming, but they enjoy it now. But that first time, it's pretty stunning for the kids, and they never turn off the music or the explosions or whatever's going on. And oh, by the way, there's a basketball game happening down there too, in case you're interested. So, some interesting news over the weekend. I can't believe the contracts they give out to some of these NBA guys now. Steph Curry signed the richest one ever, Supermax, $201 million, by the way. So dinner's on him tonight, everyone. So once you raise the level and those players start making that much money, you get all these middle guys that, it's okay, 15 points a game. Oh, $100 million? It just doesn't seem right to me. But people will come back and say, well, the owners are making billions, so I guess you pay the players millions, but I don't know. At some point, it gets ridiculous.
They should make a system where you only get paid for how many points you scored the year before or whatever your statistical variety is. Could be defensive player, whatever it is. Based on your performance, you're paid that amount for the year before, something like that.
Well, I think they do build in bonus structures, to where they do get paid more, but again, once you're making so much, it's – Well, you know, a lot of players want to go to Texas or Florida because there's no income tax.
Right.
And that's a huge, huge deal when you're, you know, and it's easy enough. I saw an analyst say, well, it's easy enough to think, well, they're making $100 million. They don't care. You do care about that other money. I mean, this is the money they're going to make for their life. So anyway, really interesting. Lots of cash going on out there. I got to renegotiate my contract. I'm a free agent.
Well, you think about those taxes for someone that rich, they're going to be paying several million more probably in any of those states that have income taxes. So that would make a pretty big difference.
It definitely would. A couple of notes today. This just happened today. It was a bus crash in Germany, 18 people dead. This is Bavarian police confirmed 18 people died Monday in a fiery bus crash. It also wounded 30 others, so terrible situation there. The coach bus carrying 46 people slammed into a truck on a highway in Germany, bursting into flames, police said. Earlier, police said the 18 people were believed to have died on the burning bus. What happened was the bus rear-ended a truck at the end of a traffic jam on the A9 highway in Münchberg in Bavaria at 7 a.m. local time. So, bad situation there. You see that sometimes. I saw a car crash yesterday just down the road from the radio station here by the Ivy's gas station.
Wow.
If listeners are familiar with Ivy's, the locals will be. If you visited, you probably are. But anyway, it's just down the road. I think it was about 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, and came upon it after it had happened, but don't know if there's any injuries. But it doesn't take much. You bang a couple of cars together, and it just completely moshes them. So hopefully people are okay, but it does happen.
Yeah, it's always sad when people get into an accident that could have been avoided most of the times. Sometimes it's a catastrophic failure of the car or something like that, but it is amazing how many people die or are severely injured from things that are completely avoidable. Even just looking at the laws about texting and driving or things like that, in some states they don't even have laws about that yet. And so there's a lot of, in our modern age, there's lots of things that can distract us from the wheel.
Yeah, it's always dangerous when you get out there on the road. You don't want to think about it too much. You freak out. But especially on highways like this situation in Germany there, you know, you're going, well, with Germany, they're going pretty fast especially. But even here, I mean, you can go 85 on some of the highways. And particularly if you've been driving for a long time and then all of a sudden traffic slows down or it stops, you know, you've got to recognize that. Sometimes people don't recognize it right away. And so anyway, that's a accident over there in Germany today, 18 dead in a fiery wreck. And I suppose there could be more as time goes on. If you live in the Northeast in the United States, especially maybe other places too, you might notice there's more ticks around and mosquitoes this year. They say that's because of a few things. This is from the New York Times. They say with the tick boom, it's not just Lyme disease you have to fear. Everybody knows about Lyme's disease, they say. Lyme disease. I always want to call it Lyme's. It's no S on it. But experts say the northern United States may be in for a bad tick season this summer, raising concerns about Lyme and other scary tick-borne diseases, including the Powassan virus, which I've never heard of, which causes encephalitis and can leave people with permanent neurological damage. They say when we think of ticks, we tend to think of deer, but Richard S. Ostfeld, a senior scientist at the Carey Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York, says it's really all about the mice. He has been studying white-footed mouse population ecology for the past 25 years. Interesting way to spend your prime working years. Every 4 or 5 years, he said, there's a bumper acorn crop, so more mice survive the following winter. It's all tied together. It's so fascinating. They breed and reach what he called mouse plague levels in the summer. These mice will be the main source of infection for the tiny larval ticks. They hatch in August, can attach to many mammals and birds, and will try to groom groom them off. And of course, then if they bite humans, they have can have that disease in there. They say they're worried about this summer. It dates back to 2015. It was one of the big acorn years. They say 2016 was the biggest mouse year we've seen in our entire 25 years of monitoring them. And so they think there's because more acorns, there's more mice. Because more mice, there's more ticks. More ticks means higher chance of getting bit. So it all ties together.
The circle of life, not too enjoyable in this case, but obviously there's more supply for all of these different creatures to go around, and so the ticks are going to be abundant. I hear some people are more susceptible to ticks than others. Not so sure if that's true, but some people say that every time they go outside almost, they come back with 5 ticks on them. Hmm. It never happens to me, so I guess there are certain people who are more juicy.
I don't know. Yeah, a lot of times it depends where you go. I mean, the tall grass place where you would see deer, mm-hmm. or where you'd see other animals like that, typically you have a chance of getting it. Like they say, you have to just check yourself, and you can put some spray on that can help. That stuff's pretty toxic too, so I guess you got to take your pick there a little bit. But yeah, you just have to keep your eye out for it. And then, of course, there's lots of indicators of those different diseases and rashes and things. You can look those up if you want to. But anyway, watch out if you're out there. And there might be more ticks this year, especially in the Northeast. Also related to that, NBC News says health officials wary as wet spring leads to more mosquitoes. It was a wetter than normal spring in the Northeast. They have a bumper crop of mosquitoes, so they're getting it from every which way. And it's funny how, because they had all this rain, it got rid of some of the drought. So that's a good thing. But then on the bad side of it, you get all these mosquitoes. And, of course, there's some diseases they're looking at there as well from the mosquitoes. So Northeast, I don't know. Maybe it's time to move. Move out to the dry desert. You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, it is interesting because I'm living in Canada, then moving down here. In Oklahoma, Oklahoma's not bad, but for certain things. But in Canada, it's so cold, it kills everything that can kill you most of the time, except for bears.
Right.
Down here, there's everything. It stays alive through the winter. Most things do. And so it is just an interesting difference of how much the climate does affect your life and the animals around you, and or in this case, the insects. And it's just... Rain brings a lot of blessings, but can unfortunately it can also bring a curse if the water is not correctly managed. So that's like what seems like what's happening in the Northeast.
Yeah, speaking of bears, there's in Alaska. There were 2 bear attacks over the course of I think it was last week, and saw a report on that over the weekend. And they have not seen they don't see a bear attack hardly ever, and to have 2 happen within a week or so. It's really, really bizarre. I think in one case, a guy was a teenager, and he was running in a race. The bear came out of the woods and killed him, I believe. And there was another attack as well up in Alaska. And then, of course, we have the shark attacks. There was another one just this weekend. So I don't know if it's more than normal or if it just is getting reported more, but it just seems like things are getting a little bit angry or something. I don't know. I mean, you know, they asked this guy in Alaska, he's some professional in the realm of bears, I guess. I don't know what they would be called, but he said that, you know, they don't know exactly why. I mean, there's could be more people. Maybe the bears are coming down looking for them. That they just don't know what the combination of things is there. But so anyway, the animals are not happy in some cases. but some people are happy, apparently. These are the happiest countries on Earth. They have a new list out. World's happiest nations. Kind of surprising, I guess, because the areas that they're in aren't great, but they think it's a cultural thing. Colombia, Chile, Norway, Mexico, Guatemala, Ecuador, Uzbekistan, Philippines, Panama, Costa Rica, and number 1, Paraguay. Mm. Happiest nations in the world. Surprise you guys?
A whole lot in Central and South America. That is pretty surprising, but at the same time, being in America, we can easily see how easy it is for people to complain a lot of the time. You know, if we go into a restaurant that doesn't have Wi-Fi, people get upset, or if the coffee doesn't have the right amount of cream on top, we get upset. So there are a lot of things that we have that are just absolute luxuries that a lot of people around the world could never even experience and thus could never even have the chance to complain about.
Yeah, they said a lot of these people in these nations seem to be happier because it's a cultural thing. They just tend to have more of a positive outlook in life. And so those were the nations. Somebody said, what do you think the happiest nation in the world is? I never would have said, you know, probably Paraguay. I don't know anything about Paraguay.
You have less, I guess. You just start to appreciate it more. You realize that it could disappear for you a little bit more easily than for some other people who are generally pretty stable in these other more affluent nations and therefore do not, you know, think as much about their blessings.
Yeah. They said the United States ranks 38th on the list with an index score of 75, tying with eight other countries. The countries that are as happy as the United States, Luxembourg, Germany, Bolivia, Brazil, Austria, the UK, Mali, and South Africa. The most unhappy nations, these will not surprise you. They're mostly, well, I'll just read the list. Uganda, Sierra Leone, Chad, Togo, Central African Republic, Liberia, Iran, South Sudan, and topping the chart is Iraq, the least happiest nation. Typically, when they do these surveys, they find the least happiest nations are in the Middle East.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense, especially usually there's a war going on there in all those African countries. Most of them, there's a civil war or some kind of massacre going on against a certain ethnic group there. So not big surprise there. Seems like having a more simplistic standard of living is a double-edged sword because it can be make you more happy because there are less things to get in the way of happiness.
Right.
Or conversely, it does lead to violence because people are fighting over resources or land or whatever it might be. So it is interesting. I think in those Latin American countries and South American countries, I think, though, the key is their happiness is directly tied to how well their football team does at the World Cup. So last time I remembered, South American teams are doing pretty good. So I think there's could be a correlation there.
That's what it is. the love for soccer. Yes.
And it seems like the extremes, it does matter, too. Like in South America, I don't think they're doing particularly well compared to most Western nations. But in general, they're probably doing a little bit better than a lot of African nations. So maybe they're poor, but they're not in danger of starvation necessarily. And there are fewer wars going on in general. I mean, Venezuela is pretty bad right now. But then you have the Middle East, and they might not even be as bad off with resources as a lot of African nations. But whenever you don't know if you're going to live past that day because of wars or terrorism, that's probably even worse than what a lot of people in Africa are going through.
Yeah. Some bad situations in some of those places. I can't even wonder how they even get in to ask people.
Right.
How do you find out what's going on in Iran? Just kind of mill about on the streets. Hey, you happy or no? Don't ask the wrong person. I wonder where Russia is on that list.
I'm surprised North Korea is not the worst.
Well, yeah, that's right. How would
they couldn't get in there?
How
probably.
Would you know? Right?
Yeah.
North Korea would probably be the worst. And well, yeah, it depends on who you ask. Again, how much pressure they feel.
If they even know that they're doing poorly. I mean, a lot of them are brainwashed into thinking that their nation is the greatest in the whole world. So if that's the case, if that's what they think, then they're probably kind of falsely happy.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to see if they thought, wow, well, things are really bad, but being that we are the greatest nation on earth, imagine how bad it is everywhere else.
Right.
Not knowing that they've been brainwashed, like you said. You guys have probably seen this around, and the listeners as well. You go into a store or somewhere else, and you see people with little animals. And it's not a pet store, because they are therapy animals. They're comforting them for some reason. Washington Post, this is a write-up. Therapy animals are everywhere, but proof that they help is not. So they're trying to look into this. Does it actually help people or not? A therapy animal trend grips the United States, and I believe that to be true. I've seen them, well, the little dogs especially. I've seen those multiple times in stores. They're in people's purses, and they're just sitting in the cart, and they're cute. I mean, I like them, but it's not the case of like a blind person with a dog or something like that. It's just a little guy in the purse. So maybe it helps them with the credit cards. Can you give me my MasterCard, please?
I actually saw a video where a guy, he had noticed that there are a lot of people walking into stores with their tiny pets in their purses, and he was trying to make sure, you know, what the criteria was for them being allowed to bring them into the store. So he actually brought a pretty big dog in.
Wow.
And all of a sudden they weren't so happy with it, but he said, hey, all these other people have their dogs. My dog's behaving. It's just sitting under the table quietly.
Yeah.
Why can't I just keep him in here?
It's just like the Old West Saloon. You bring the horse into the bar.
I mean, it does seem like there has to be a limit. A lot of people probably, it's like a placebo to them to have a little dog in their purse. So they don't really need that, but it's kind of a luxury or a comfort item.
You would think at some point it'd be a health concern too.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to, like, especially if they're selling food and things like that.
Yeah, it reminds me on the British Tube in London, they made a new rule that you couldn't bring a dog unless it could fit into a bag. And so people were like, okay, well, we'll see about this. So then the next day there were pictures of people have huge duffel bags, and they had like German Shepherds, Golden Retrievers, and they're just like in a little, like a huge purse, but they fit the dog in there.
It's in the bag. Yeah, letter of the law there. There's last week in the subway in New York, there was somebody had a raccoon. They were feeding it, and then there was a snake. So it's getting interesting. So they're looking at the... I don't think raccoons are comfort animals, but therapy animals.
Oh, yeah,
but
not at all.
Here's my possum. Just makes me feel better. they say universities nationwide bring dogs and a donkey, in one case, onto campus to soothe the students during finals. A donkey? Now, I don't know. Would that soothe you if a donkey was... You were close to a donkey. Yeah. We can all relax now.
All my experiences are they're the most obstinate, annoying animals ever. Just loud. They don't do what you want almost unless you force them to.
They kick you if you got too close. If you tried to take a ride, it probably wouldn't budge.
Right.
Doesn't seem like the most comforting choice.
They're also bringing llamas into hospitals to help patients. Don't llamas spit at people?
They sure do.
On occasion.
Yeah. And of course, they're bringing, you know, the dogs everywhere, and horses are being used. I don't even want to read that. It's just strange. There are also some people are bringing ducks on planes. So
how is that possible?
I don't know.
That's the next Samuel Jackson movie, Ducks on a Plane. So.
Yes, that's for the kids. It might be an emotional support animal, they say, prescribed by a mental health professional. So that's kind of the... The ticket, if you can get a mental health professional to say you need this animal, then I guess you can kind of do what you want. They say the trend, which has accelerated hugely since its initial stirrings a few decades ago, is underpinned by a widespread belief that interaction with animals can reduce stress, whether it happens over a brief period of time at the airport or in a long-term, you know, relationship at home where it's your own animal. Certainly the groups offering up pets think this, as do some mental health professionals, but the popular embrace of pets as furry therapists is causing growing discomfort among some researchers in the field who say it has raced far ahead of the scientific evidence. So they're looking at some studies, and right now it seems to, the indication they have is that an animal might help you very minimally, temporarily, but it's not some long-term cure or needed situation to overcome, you know, a particular problem or to stay calm or whatever the issue might be. So there's that battle between those that say it is a must and then the research saying that it's probably not as necessary as some would think. So probably depends on your love of animals, where you come down on that topic.
This sort of seems like a rare case where you could sort of disregard a lot of the scientific evidence and just go with your feelings, because that's really what it comes down to. If a certain person feels comfortable with an animal, I don't really know if a scientist could say, actually, you really don't feel comfortable with an animal, and try to read that person's mind, maybe.
Yeah, well, and people are, you know, are different. I mean, some people are very comfortable around animals and others don't care for them as much. You know, dogs, for example, they can be really great or they can bite you. I mean, you can have a certain fear of them or other animals like that. So it's an interesting trend, and you see them around more and more. So I think probably where it becomes a bit of an issue is where one person says, I need this, but they're maybe imposing on the general group because of it. You know, I need to bring this duck on the plane. I don't know how I would feel about that. I guess if it didn't bother me, I'd be okay with it. But at some point, it almost seems sort of third worldish, doesn't it? To like just random animals like roaming amongst the more public areas.
Yeah, it's like an agricultural cargo plane or something. It's not even meant for passengers as much anymore.
Well, and then even, I mean, allergies too, right? Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have a lot of severe allergies. So what if you're allergic to the duck or the dog? Or even, you know, some people have some real issues with that. So it would come down to, does one person's need for this therapy animal override another person's need to not be near an animal because of an I mean, there's all kinds of arguments that could come in there, and it is an interesting discussion. I guess I don't have a big thought on it other than there are some places I would like to go and probably not have an animal there. I don't need a donkey at the grocery store unless it's outside and go up and look at it, but I don't want it in the store with me.
We should all feel sort of a compulsion to avoid being a nuisance to other people or a burden or being inconsiderate. And that's really where it does become something probably that shouldn't be done too commonly. People don't want to go to a restaurant and see a duck there. They don't want to go on the airplane and see a horse. I mean, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to be doing things like that because, again, where does it stop? How big can the animal be if you start allowing small animals? What is stopping you from eventually adding larger animals or more animals into one space? It can really get to a pretty strange extreme if you just keep letting it go and go.
Yeah.
There was, this reminded me of a story, because I think, to me, the biggest problem is just health and cleanliness, because some, like, ducks aren't meant to be interacting with humans. They carry things if you're not careful, but...
I was to apologize to all the duck lovers out there.
I am a duck lover, though. I love ducks, but we're meant to be in separate worlds. But it reminds me, one place where animals actually are very therapeutic is with soldiers,
mm-hmm.
and... on the ships, they used to have the cats that were the mousers. And there is one, I saw this the other day, his name is Unsinkable Sam. And he was the mouser on the Bismarck. And when the British sunk the Bismarck, they saved him from the Atlantic. And he served on two other British ships. I think he survived another shipwreck. But he's named Unsinkable Sam because no matter what ship he was on, if it sunk, he somehow survived. But it's those mousing cats that actually helped the sailors endure all the stress and the traumatic events that actually helped them cope with it a little better.
Yeah, there's definitely some good things you can gain from having some of those pets, but it is an interesting discussion. So the Washington Post is looking into it. Therapy animals are everywhere. Proof that they help is not. How are you going to prove it, right? You don't need that dog.
Yes, I do.
I do. You're listening to Trumper Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We don't have any therapy animals in the studio with us at this time that I'm aware of.
Just a little card of Ronald Reagan over there keeping us company.
We do have animals. I mean, we do have spiders that crawl around, but they don't make me feel better. They make me feel worse.
A fake lion over there.
Yeah.
That's not.
Well, imagine if somebody had a therapy tarantula. You take it on a plane or something. You're like, well, don't worry. I need it for my... You know, it would terrify everyone else.
So we just need to keep it confined then to a certain environment. Like if you're talking about a therapeutic ranch or something like that for soldiers, that would be mm-hmm. totally permissible. It wouldn't be kind of intruding on other people's privacy or rights.
I think the rule should be, if you want to bring your therapy animal, you have to train it to sit on your head under a giant hat. And if you can do that, then you can take it. But no one can know that it's there. Why do you have that huge hat? There's a duck on my head. It's Bill, you know, like a ball cap. Key Day of Programs coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, from Edmond, Oklahoma today. Talking about a few topics, including some of the news items that are mentioned on thetrumpet.com. Top story today is about the greenhouse apocalypse. It sounds like plants dying in a greenhouse. It says, do carbon dioxide emissions threaten all life on Earth? Who was it? One of the famous guys. Stephen Hawking? I think it was him who he said President Trump was going to raise the temperature of the Earth like 250 degrees or something because of his policies, and the audience was weeping. And so that I read the headline. I didn't see the whole story. But anyway, so people are really worried about this. Some people are. What the Paris Climate Agreement was really about by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, and why natural disasters. Those are all at thetrumpet.com today and talked about somewhat on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as well. So make sure you listen for that and check out those headlines. Grant, you have a write-up for us here. It's by Melanie Phillips, who stopped by Herbert W. Armstrong College, where we're broadcasting from, a couple months ago, and gave a lecture. She has a write-up in the Jerusalem Post. As I see it, the fight to the death in Britain and America. She's been warning for a long time about some of the problems in these nations. What does she have to say?
Well, she covers a lot of the recent history. I mean, you could write several thousand words at least about just the recent chaotic terrorist attacks or even just other incidents of violence. And she's really just focusing on the reaction to these different types of events. For example, with these Islamic terrorist attacks that have been taking place in Britain, people are very quick to point out that it's not all Muslims. And I think everyone knows that, but they still feel the need to tell us that anyway. But then when it comes to that man who was trying to run Muslims over in a van recently over there, they're very quick to judge everyone who speaks out against Islamic extremism. Every single person who is critical of terrorism is now at fault for that man running Muslims over in a van. So they're not going to generalize Muslims, but they will quickly generalize anyone who is against terrorism.
Yeah. Yeah, we see that with, well, anytime there's an attack, you can almost follow the script. You know what's going to be said by the political leaders in the media, and it seems to follow the same pattern. And so it's really difficult to root out terrorism when it's not, it can't even really be identified other than sort of a general thing almost that is attaches itself to random people at random times. That, you know, that'd be like saying, well, you know, we're going to fight, I don't know, pick a war. We're going to fight, instead of saying we're going to fight that country, we're going to fight their the idea of something. And well, if you don't know who is doing it, then you're not going to win that battle.
Right. And then she just writes, she's talking about this sort of moral equivalence problem that the West has. She says, thus the global Islamic Jihad, which has claimed tens of thousands of lives, was equated with a minute number of retaliatory acts by a few fringe groups or truly random individuals. So if you did stack up the body count of radical Islamic terrorism versus those who might retaliate against those types of events or those who truly are lone wolves, unlike a lot of the people who are called lone wolves by the media, who are actually terrorists inspired by ISIS in a lot of cases, it is interesting to see that they still will equate the two as if they are equal threats to all people in civilization.
Yeah, which, of course, it's been pretty rare that there's been, like, that UK attack where that guy drove the, I guess it was the van, right into that mosque area. Maybe there's probably been a few things like that. That's the only one I can think of recently. If there's another one, it escapes my memory.
Well, that's the thing. It's extremely rare, and it tends to be a lot less successful anyway. I mean, we've heard of terrorist attacks killing 20, 30, even over 100 people. Usually the retaliation doesn't kill anyone. Maybe it injures a few or it kills one person. So the body count is, it's not even close. And also just the number of attacks, it's not even close. But the media will instead, they'll still focus on the retaliation instead of the root problem that is really plaguing the West, which is sort of another hostile civilization infiltrating and carrying out attacks on these host nations' own soil.
And so what Melanie Phillips is, I guess, getting to here is that until you identify the root cause of the problem, yeah, I mean, you're never going to get rid of it. And eventually, you know, there's going to be such problems that something has to happen one way or the other. I mean, you can't just let it continue. I guess because our nations are so large, we are able to somehow, I guess, absorb these attacks, sadly, for a while. I mean, they keep happening in the UK especially. We've seen them here in the US. But there's a lot of people here and, you know, 10 killed here, 20 there. It's a huge, huge deal. But yet, considering the general population and so forth, it seems like people are willing to sort of accept it for now.
Mm-hmm.
Not that anybody wants to see it, but at the same time, I don't think anyone really, at least in the leadership roles, wants to go out and solve the problem because that would be pretty involved.
Yeah, and that's the issue she brings out. The way that these different attacks are being covered in such a biased manner is actually leading to political depravity. For example, there in Britain, they had an Iran-backed Al-Quds Day rally. People marching behind the flags of Hezbollah, screaming anti-Jewish incitement, equating Zionists with ISIS. Because again, remember, they're both supposedly equal threats. Those who commit these terrorist attacks and those who might retaliate, no matter how unequal they are, they're proclaimed as equal. And so now you have people like Jeremy Corbyn, who is a friend of Hamas and Hezbollah, who literally does associate kindly with those types of people. And he is gaining a huge number of votes over there, 40% in the latest election over in Britain. And it all really does stem from just wrongly identifying the problem. They're not even pointing out who the enemy is. And so because they don't have a clear vision of the enemy, they're actually totally fine with a politician who doesn't know who the enemy is either.
Yeah, we've seen that happen a lot over in Israel, where there'd be an attack over there and against the Israelis usually, and the Israelis would retaliate in some fashion, and then over in the U.S., the leaders here would come out and say, well, both sides need to tamp down the the violence, making it out like both sides are guilty, when in the reality there's an instigator and then there's somebody defending themselves, but that wasn't identified, and it's the same thing happening here with the terrorism and so forth.
And another thing that Melanie Phillips also points out is just that because the media and because the radical left have stirred up so much hatred against the government, both in Britain and America, whenever you see some radical on the street attacking people or burning buildings, that is considered legitimate resistance. That's also how a lot of young people especially start to view terrorists, because of course they're attacking these evil governments in the West. They're trying to overthrow the system, just like these radical communists like Jeremy Corbyn are trying to do. So they don't even really understand the forces of evil that are trying to overthrow these nations. They've been convinced that Britain and America especially have been built on racism and sexism, and therefore they are evil and must be overthrown by any means necessary. They have sympathies towards some very unsavory people.
Yep, we see that everywhere. We see it in the U.S. as well, even within people that are all Americans but have different ethnic backgrounds. That's from Melanie Phillips at the Jerusalem Post. As I see it, the fight to the death in Britain and America. She writes some really good stuff. But she also just has a lot of critics, too. People don't agree. The popular media does not agree with her assessment.
They call her a reactionary, a Nazi, even though she's a Jew. You know, someone tried to describe her as a rat that eats broken bottles, something like that.
Wow.
Just a crazy description of her. And yet all she's doing is acknowledging reality. She was a child of the left. And yet, because she actually tried to do her job as a journalist and follow the truth wherever it led, she was totally disowned by these people who have an ideology that trumps all the facts.
Yeah, she has a book out, Guardian Angel, that talks about a lot of her history. So it's a good read if you get a chance to pick that up. You have one other one that we can maybe look at quickly from the town hall. The Progressive Boomerang. I like boomerangs. I don't know that I like a progressive boomerang, but... So what is this one about?
Well, this one is, we sort of alluded to this briefly the other day, just the absolute blatant hypocrisy of the left trying to pin President Trump on some sort of collusion with Russia. They've been so focused on trying to undermine him even before he took office that now it's actually coming back. It's boomeranging back on them, because even if you just think about this logically for a second, President Trump was an outsider. He was never involved in politics before. All these people on the left have been involved in politics for decades. Of course, they're going to have closer ties with Russia than Mr. Trump is, at least in a political sense. So because they've been putting the spotlight on Mr. Trump and Russia so much, they've actually been finding a lot of things about Russia and their connections with the left in America. Yeah. It's actually coming back to hurt them. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, a former attorney general, was meeting with former President Bill Clinton on the tarmac in an airplane right before she went and questioned Hillary Clinton about the email scandal, which she also told James Comey to call a matter instead of an investigation. There have been a lot of things like that. And then, of course, there have been other issues where President Obama was caught whispering to Dmitry Medvedev that whenever he gets elected and whenever he got elected in 2012, he would then start doing more favors for Russia. There's connections between the Clinton Foundation and Russia, them doing favors for Russian interests as long as Russia would pay their foundation. So there are all these ties everywhere. It just baffles you to even try to figure out why they would choose this area to attack the president. I mean, yesterday he tweeted something about him body slamming a guy who had like a CNN logo over his head.
Right, Vince McMahon.
And there are plenty of other things you could probably criticize. I mean, they do, I guess, touch on those types of things. Those are also trivial, but you know, you could talk about healthcare or the economy and try to bring up other agendas. But what Victor Davis Hanson is bringing up is that they're not even trying to give an alternative to some of Mr. Trump's policies. They're just trying to undermine him and overthrow him. That's not too palatable to most people in America. Most people are not so radical that they would want to overthrow the entire democratic process in the country. They want to see which ideas are better and can be implemented more successfully.
Yeah, that is the interesting thing. If you investigate some matters too deeply, you find there's more fingers in the pie than you may have hoped for. So that is interesting. That's from Town Hall, the progressive boomerang. What's that thing that people always say when you're a kid, you know, when you point at somebody, you're like, well, you got one finger pointing at me, but four are pointing back at you.
Right.
Yeah. Give or take, depending on what your thumb's doing, I guess. I can never quite understand. Yeah. And one's pointing randomly to the side. Yeah. Couldn't figure that one out when I was a kid. We do see that that happening with some of these investigations. There's plenty to investigate, and not the media doesn't want to really investigate all of it. Here's something that could be good news. I'm hoping, even though I think the title's probably trying to mislead me, but Abe, you've got this from Spectator Health. Sleep deprived, they say? Well, yes. How did you know? Undo the damage with chocolate. So you can stay up late and then eat a candy bar. That's what I'm reading this as.
Yeah, that's slightly different than what the research suggests.
I knew it.
Because candy bars have things other than chocolate in them.
Chocolate bar, just a chocolate bar.
Yeah. So what this research, it was done from the University of L'Aquila in Italy, basically that the flavanols in cocoa have a positive effect on cognitive performance. And so they did this research and they looked at it, immediate effects after a day's intake and after several months to see how it affects people. And they realized that if you do, the flavanols in cocoa do help your cognitive abilities. They help your blood flow and different things. And so they found that with women, if you didn't have a good night's sleep, the next day you can have a little bit of cocoa and it will actually help you combat the impairment usually from lack of sleep.
Mm.
So they found that and it works. It helps with working memory and improve visual information processing. So for a lot of college students who pull all-nighters, the next day you have to go to class and sit through another 50 lectures. If you have a little bit of chocolate in the morning, it could help you be more alert. To take in information.
It would have to be just chocolate.
Like, yes.
It couldn't be Cocoa Puffs.
Correct.
It says cocoa in it, but that's not what they mean.
Yeah, and yeah. So that's the thing is with, they say that it's with chocolate. The actual like chocolate, natural chocolate is good for you. It can have beneficial effects. They say, however, there are potential side effects, including the high caloric count usually comes with eating chocolate.
Literally, your front and back and sides will be affected.
Yes, yeah. All around effects. And they also said that there are the chemical compounds such as caffeine and theobromine, which can have effects you don't want. But also, with most chocolate, we throw in extra things like sugar, milk, those types of things with the chocolate. So what this research is about really dark chocolate or just cocoa. It's not talking about the chocolate you go find in the candy aisle.
Right.
That's the sugar and other things they add to it will nullify the effects. What they're talking about is if you have cocoa powder, really dark chocolate, just a little bit in the morning might help you feel more alert. So that's what they're talking about with this study.
I think, very popular if somebody, maybe they already do, but if they sold it as that, like they marketed it like this will help you, you know, be more alert, and it's chocolate. I mean, who wouldn't buy that? I'd rather do that than, I don't know, some of the other alternatives that are out there.
5-hour energy.
Yeah, because it's delicious anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and if it actually has a few benefits to you, I don't know what you'd call it, but yeah, I bet that you could market that and people would, even if they're not tired, they'd be like, I'm feeling a little groggy.
Some things you can do is, if you eat cereal, most cereals aren't that great, but if you eat cereal or fruit or something in the morning, whatever you eat, granola, oatmeal. Just put a little bit of cocoa powder on it, and it could help you with these things. And they found that if you do this regularly for about 5 days a week for 3 months, they found that it actually had really positive effects, especially in older people, because the cocoa flavanols reduced the effects of aging in the brain. So it helped them with just remembering things, and they found that the flavanols, that increases cerebral blood volume to the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus.
Of course.
Yes, I was all on the tip of our tongues. So it actually helps with the hippocampus, which is memory, with older people. So if you, they found that the cocoa reduces the effects of aging in the brain. So it has to be done in balance, and has to be done healthy cocoa. But it's still, chocolate can be really healthy for you.
Yeah. Well, I'm very impressed that you could say some of those words, too. Not easy.
I did pray before coming on, so that probably helped.
Great. Good job. It's from Spectator Health. Sleep deprived? Undo the damage with chocolate. And finally today, you wanted to talk about a little bit of the history of the Battle of Gettysburg, and probably good to talk about. You know, what I meant to look up was the fireworks thing, and I forgot about that.
Oh, right.
Like why we do the fireworks on the 4th.
I can look it up.
Grant will research,
I'll stealthily
of course.
Look it up right now.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, never mind that. How about Gettysburg?
Yeah, so between July 1st and 4th, it really ended on the 3rd, the major conflicts. But it was the Battle of Gettysburg, fought in Pennsylvania in 1863. And in the battle, you had about 170,000 men, 95,000 under General Meade of the Army of the Potomac, which is for the North, and about 75,000 under General Lee for the Army of North Virginia, which was the Confederate Army. And so this is right after the Battle of Chancellorsville, where Stonewall Jackson died, and the Confederacy had its biggest victory of the war, completely routed the Union Army. And so Lee had a new corps commander in Robert Ewell instead of Jackson in the Second Corps. And so this would have some pretty big effects on the day. And as they marched north, basically going on a raid against the Union, the first time they went on the offense during the whole war, crossing the border, it started off as an engagement where it was piecemeal. Both armies didn't really know where each other were. And they found each other at Gettysburg, and so more and more parts of the army started becoming engaged. And so the highlights of the battle, the climax of the battle was the Battle of Little Round Top, where I think it was the 1st Maine regiment from the north, they held off the Pickett's charge and other, I think that actually was somewhere else, but they held off the Confederacy. Little Round Top was around the flank. If the Confederates got Little Round Top, which is a little hill, they could have turned the whole flank of the Union Army. And so the Union held that. They ran out of ammunition, and they did a bayonet charge, and they held off the Confederacy. Probably the most dramatic battle of the whole war, little skirmish of the whole war. And so Gettysburg is interesting because a lot of people think it was a turning point where the South had a lot of success, and after Gettysburg, they started to lose, and that's when General Grant became Supreme Commander a little while afterwards. And so what's interesting looking at Gettysburg, 50,000 men were killed, wounded, or captured. So it's still the deadliest battle in American history. And it was brutal, fought in the summer heat. It took months to bury the dead bodies. And so there was a lot of carnage there left for months and months afterwards. And Gettysburg really pictures what the Civil War was about. And that was just bitter loss, both sides fighting really an inconclusive battle, neither side really gaining an advantage. And so the best summary of Gettysburg was when President Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address. And he really summarized it best when he said that this war is about establishing freedom. And that that's what was at cost, or that's what was at stake in the Civil War. And Gettysburg kind of was that turning point when the Union would be saved. There was no point after that, where militarily the Union was under threat, really. Morale almost wavered in 1864 before Sherman captured Atlanta. But for the most part, this was the great turning point when the Union was saved, and we have this great nation united instead of fractured in hatred. And so I think the main value of looking at this history today is if we look at American society, American politics are very divisive. The whole country's divided over many, many different issues. And if we look at before the Civil War, America was much the same. It was a political struggle fought in Congress and in state legislators, but the rhetoric became more and more violent. People started fighting each other in the streets, and eventually it led to war. And so we're seeing the same cycle happen today. But if you look at this history, just the way men died, the 50,000, they estimate about 750,000 men died during the whole Civil War. Just the massive loss that that war entailed, that it took that war to get back national unity. It took extreme struggle. And so we should really rethink the trajectory we're on, the language we're using, the tactics both sides are using. Because once you lose peace, once you lose unity, it's very hard to get it back. And sometimes it does take a war to bring the nation back together.
Yeah, and either both sides, I suppose, of the political debate today, you know, they kind of point the finger at the other leader. And in this case now, of course, we have more of a Republican leader, I guess. I don't know what you would call him. He's not really conservative, but he's sort of in that realm. And where the other side would point and say, well, he's not a legitimate leader. And then there was probably some that said the same about the past president. So it's we're getting almost to that point where even when somebody gets in through the process, there's a lot of accusations of it not being valid or legitimate. And so obviously the same sort of thing would have been happening back then too. Each side had a leader. They had a president, but not everybody recognized them. And so we have some of those similarities too.
Yeah, it's really, we're seeing two societies develop within the United States. You have a more traditional conservative type of living. Then you have extreme progressive type of society. And we've seen just some states even say, well, we want to secede maybe or defy the federal government because our way of life is better than theirs, the one that they're espousing. And that's what was happening in the Civil War. You had the South, which was more conservative, but they had slavery, and you had the North, which was a little more liberal, industrialized. But they were two distinct societies, and that's what was at battle. And the politics just reflected that. But I think the most worrying part of this history is that we had a Lincoln. We had President Lincoln as a leader of the North, and it was his genius, his character, his belief in God that really saved America and kept it from being permanently broken into two. And so it was that type of leadership, which we all recognize as great, and something that was very providential that he came in right when he needed to be there. But we have no leaders like that even close to the stature of Lincoln, but we're approaching a crisis of equal magnitude. And so I think that's the most worrying part, is that history repeats itself, but this time we don't have a man of Lincoln's character and a man of Lincoln's faith to lead America back to where it needs to be. And to me, that's the most terrifying part of this, is that the Civil War could have easily gotten out of control if there weren't strong men leading both sides. Because even the Confederacy had leaders who kept the war civil and a gentleman's war as much as it could have been, instead of going into something that could have been a lot worse. But on both sides, there are no leaders really keeping bounds. And to me, that's very worrying.
Yeah, really good history to look at. And I don't think that people really even know what they would be fighting about today, like fighting for. It would be extreme lawlessness, right?
Yeah.
Like, especially with the progressive side. Just, we don't want any laws of any kind. But then you have anarchy. Like, how do you rule a society where there's no laws?
Yeah.
it's not even, it just baffles mind. But anyway, you kind of looked at it right up there that you wrote on the trumpet, right? The title, what was the title of that?
The title is Anniversary of Gettysburg, A House Divided Cannot Stand.
Right.
And that's from Mark 3:25. So Lincoln quoted Jesus Christ trying to evoke a principle that the nation can only stand if it's united.
Yeah. So you can read more of that at thetrumpet.com. Grant, did you find the answer to why the fireworks on the 4th of July?
I did. It goes back to John Adams, the second U.S. president. Before he was even the president, he wrote to his wife, Abigail Adams, on July 3rd, 1776, that the occasion of the birth of the country should be celebrated, quote, with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illumination from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore. And so it actually started the next year, July 4th, 1777, and it's been going on ever since.
Yeah. Well, we've had, three or four nights in a row now, just sitting out in the yard watching the neighbors shoot all those fireworks up. It's quite a sight. It's always fun to watch. I don't know. I mean, and they put on quite a show, some of my neighbors. So I don't feel all that compelled to do much other than watch and applaud their efforts. So it's if you're hoping to, if you're in the local area here in Edmond, Oklahoma City, especially out near this campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College, a lot of people shoot fireworks. You're not going to have a great night's rest, probably. It's going to be going late over the next few days. And a lot of places around the United States do that. Some places are a little more lenient than others as far as what they allow. But here where we are, anything goes.
Yeah, America always does it big. I mean, for a month leading up to July 4th, and even for a month after, a lot of time, and even sometimes the rest of the year, we just set off fireworks. But it really did start out as a classy occasion. It was written that everything was conducted with the greatest order and decorum, and the face of joy and gladness was universal. That was back in 1777 at the first celebration.
Cool. Well, it's nice to know. I think people would be happier if we had like 9:30 every night, 10 minutes of fireworks. Just end the day, go to bed. I think everybody would be a much happier
Definitely.
Person. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. Myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau. Have a great rest of your Monday. We'll talk to you again soon.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.